So today I'm going to start with some final comments on most of what we've been talking about up till now, which is causal compatibility for the classical case. And then I'm going to move on to kind of estimating causal effects, the strengths of causal effects. So the question we've been asking mostly is, you know, just a decision problem. If you have like a set of causal structures, we've just been trying to figure out which of those causal structures are actually compatible with the data we've observed. And we noticed that, you know, if you can do interventions on all the variables, then you can sort of settle that question. But if you've just got passive observations, then this is a non-trivial problem. So you want to figure out exactly what are all the equality constraints that your observed data would satisfy for a given causal structure. What are the inequality constraints? And in particular, the inequality constraints are difficult to computationally work out. So that's what we've been focused on. And I just want to note that we've been in kind of one area of this problem space, and there's sort of more general versions of this problem. So we talked about, you know, Bayesian causal networks where I stipulate for every variable the conditional probability of that variable given its parents, which determines the observed statistics by this sort of formula. And so I could restrict the possibilities for those conditionals. So we've been assuming thus far that they're generic, and furthermore, that the latent variable can have any cardinality you like. But one could imagine changing those assumptions. And so if I go to the case of a structural equation model, where instead of just conditional probabilities, I explicitly represent all the kind of latent variables that locally act on any given variable. So now y becomes a function of x, lambda, and gamma. I think I made a mistake here. Yeah, y should be depending on gamma, x should be depending on omega. And so I could say, all right, well, that probabilistic dependence was just due to ignorance of what gamma was, but I can stipulate the probability distribution over gamma and just specify the actual causal mechanism, the function that determines y in terms of its parents, the function that determines x in terms of its parents, and the distributions over the latent variables, in which case the conditional probability looks like this. And so again, I can say in this language, I can restrict the kinds of distributions over the latents that are allowed. I can also restrict the kinds of functional dependences that are allowed. So in terms of restrictions on the functional dependences, there's a lot of different versions that have been studied. So in particular, there's been a lot of work done on when some of those dependences, some of those functional dependences are linear. That tends to make things quite a bit easier to analyze. Monotonic functions are also a case that often gets used, an assumption that often gets made, and it's plausible in certain contexts. In physics, it makes sense to say, well, these aren't any old functions, these are symplectic functions. If the kinds of variables I'm talking about are, you know, things that I expect to undergo Hamiltonian dynamics, then these will be not generic functions. Another common assumption is that, you know, X might depend in, Y might depend on some generic way in X, but the noise, gamma, will just be added to the value of y, so that dependence on the noise is just linear and additive. And you might also have situations where, for example, the functional dependences of one variable on its parents is mirrored somewhere else because of certain symmetries, that they're not independent types of functions of the same function, or that the kinds of noise you have is parallel, you know, it's the same kind of noise for some variables. There could be lots of different ways of implementing symmetries in your problem. And then over on the side of the distributions over the latent variables, again, you could say, well, it's not any old distribution. It could be just Gaussian distributions that describe the noise. Or I could imagine the latent variables have restricted cardinality and certain kinds of distributions over that. And I could also imagine symmetries among those distributions as well. So as you sort of vary all these possibilities, you get a whole slew of different problems you might try to solve. And so all the causal compatibility questions we've been asking up till now could be asked in these contexts. You can say, well, what if I know the cardinalities of latent variables? How can I figure out what the observational equivalence classes are and thereby figure out for given data which causal structure could explain it, or for linear dependences, or for any of these other assumptions? So you can bring your assumptions and then say there's an appropriate causal compatibility for each of them. And very roughly speaking, the more assumptions you put in, so the stronger your assumptions, like you assume linear and you know the cardinalities and you know the noise, The stronger your assumptions, the stronger you will be, the stronger causal conclusions you can draw. So you'll be more able to distinguish different causal structures the more assumptions you make. So what we've been talking about mostly is the end of the spectrum where you're making very weak assumptions. You don't know what the cardinalities of the latent variables are. You don't have any restrictions on the nature of the distributions of the latents. You don't have any restrictions on the nature of the functions. Even there, we saw we could draw some, you know, solid causal conclusions. But you do even better if you can bring some domain expertise. You know your data comes from a certain domain, and you can bring some extra assumptions. Like you say, well, I know it's plausible that this is a linear dependence, or I know that these should be symplectic functions, or whatever. Then you can generally leverage that to get better conclusions. So all across that spectrum, from weak to strong assumptions, there's really scope for new techniques to be developed. I think there's lots more that can be done, not just in the generic case that we've been talking about, but for every one of these particular examples. So I just wanted to make sure that it was clear that there's sort of lots more versions of the stuff we've been talking about up till now. Every time you do make a restriction on the parameters in your causal model, you're really defining a model class of distributions. So let me stipulate what I mean by that. Say this structural equation model I flashed earlier, if I tell you what set of possibilities the function f and the function g are drawn from, I'll use the calligraphic script for that, and I tell you what set of possibilities the distribution of the latents are drawn from, that will define a set of possibilities for the conditional x, y given z, you know, that's implied by that sort of causal structure. So this is, you can think of this as a statistician's model class. It's like, you know, you want to know, do the conditional probabilities lie in the model class that's defined by my causal structure in this particular restriction? So it's all about sort of characterizing those classes of models under these different restrictions, and then you can use that as a test for compatibility. Okay, and you can do, of course, the same thing in a Bayesian causal model if you stipulate your restrictions natively on the conditional probabilities rather than on the functional dependencies. Okay, so that's what the small bit I wanted to say about causal compatibility. Now let me say a little bit more about going beyond the decision problem of, is this causal structure possible or not, to, let's say I have many causal structures that are compatible with the data, right? The data could have come from any one of these. How can I adjudicate between those and say which one is more likely to have generated the data? So that's just what I said here. If you've got a number of them, which often happens, like the chain and the fork, for example, give exactly the same sorts of equality constraints, or X causes Y and Y causes X. In the absence of other assumptions, those give all the same distributions. Which one is more likely to be the correct explanation? Okay, so let me just clarify one distinction that's particularly important for quantum applications. You can talk about the infinite run statistics that are predicted for, say, out of some operational theory like quantum theory, and then you can ask, well, you know, for those theoretical predictions, you know, I have a theory like quantum mechanics tells me exactly what the probabilities will be in the infinite run limit. So I can ask for those probabilities, which causal explanations are possible? And there's no ambiguity about the probability distribution. It's given to me by this theoretical model. Versus, compare that to a situation where you've just got some finite run statistics that you've achieved in some experiment doing passive observation, and you want to know which causal explanations are consistent with what I've seen. Very different kinds of problems in a way. So an example of that contrast would be in the quantum literature, when you read a no-go theorem, like Bell's theorem, for example, it tells you that the idealized statistics that are predicted by operational quantum theory are incompatible with some classical causal model, namely the one that has the causal structure of the Bell diag. So if you read Bell's 1964 paper, he says, quantum mechanics predicts that these kinds of probability distributions are possible in principle. And his 1964 argument actually leverages idealized predictions of theory, like perfect correlations, things we don't see in the lab, but that quantum theory predicts are true. He uses those in his argument. That's quite different from having a technique that'll take finite run experimental data and can now rule out with high confidence the possibility of some classical causal model that has the causal structure of the Bell diag. So that was not done in Bell's 1964 paper. So this is my example up here. I bring Bell's 1964 argument. Actually, Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, and Holt were the first ones to write down inequalities that were robust to noise, so that it didn't appeal to the correlations being perfect. You could actually take the imperfect correlations you might get out of a Bell experiment and test the inequalities on that. Another example of a no-go theorem on the top was, for example, that I briefly ran through Lucian Hardy's argument, which you'll remember appealed to the fact that quantum theory predicts that certain events occur with probability zero. And that's, again, something you don't expect to see. Like, you only have a certain amount of confidence that a certain probability is really zero if you've done a finite run. So it's not the kind of thing that you could easily go to the lab and make use of. Okay, so let's start with sort of that idealized case and ask, you know, if somebody gives me some predictions from a theory, then how should I prefer different causal explanations? So one thing you can do is say, if you have the whole observational dominance order, then it makes sense to prefer those models that are lower in the lowest in the order and still consistent with your data. Okay, and the principle here is basically that those models that are lower in the order can explain less. So they're more falsifiable. And so there's a general principle in the philosophy of science that you should tend to prefer models that are more falsifiable.
Lowest in order, you mean the weaker depths?
Yeah, the ones that have like more conditional dependencies, more inequality constraints. So like if I flash back our, for the three node DAGs, where you can have some latent variables, this was the observational dominance order. So the idea is that if I see some data that's, you know, consistent with this, it makes more sense to assume that that's the causal explanation rather than anything above it, right? Because it is easier to falsify this hypothesis than any of the ones above it. So that's sort of the best hypothesis is the most falsifiable one. So that's a general principle that often gets leveraged. And now I want to note, I mean, there's a lot that could be said here. I'm going to say very little, but there's a notion, and it was already in Popper's work that I think has been discredited, that it is possible to sort of gauge falsifiability simply by parameter counting. So I think in physics, we hear a lot of this, that, oh, if you want to know which is your more falsifiable model, then just find the one with the fewest numbers of parameters. But there's lots of evidence out there that that's too naive. And so causal inference provides a nice example. If I take the saturating class and the triangle class, and these are strictly ordered in that observational dominance order, and I calculate how many parameters of freedom I have, well, let's take A, B, and C to be binary. So the hidden variable here, which is the common cause of all three, this is part of the saturating class, it can get away with just having cardinality 8 because there's only 8 possibilities for the string of bits A, B, C. So I could just encode whatever distribution I want on A, B, C, encode it in lambda, make lambda 3 bits. There's one parameter that's lost for normalization, so there's 7 parameters of freedom here, and I can describe any distribution. The triangle, I talked a little bit about how we kind of know something about the minimal cardinality of these guys I can make. The point is that I can easily prove that the cardinality of each of these three guys has to be at least 3, and therefore there has to be at least 9 parameters in this model. So the argument is as follows. One of the distributions over A, B, C I can generate would be perfect correlation between A and C and B uncorrelated from that. And to generate all the possible, or not necessarily perfect correlation, but any old correlation between A and C, that the way to do that, I need 3 parameters in lambda, right? Because A and C are each bit, so there's 4 possibilities. So I would need 3, at least 4 minus 1, 3 parameters in lambda to generate arbitrary correlations here. And that's true of each of these guys. So there's at least 9 parameters. There's a result that shows that with 6 parameters, sorry, cardinality 6 for each, so I guess 18 minus 1, 17 parameters in all, you can do everything. So you need more than 7 parameters is the point. And yet, the distributions I can generate over ABC here are a strict subset of these. These are all distributions. This is a strict subset.
Sorry, what do you subtract 1 for,
except for memory? For normalization. So I have a distribution over an 8-valued lambda here. That means there's 7 real numbers that are free. The 8th is fixed by normalization.
When you were counting the cardinality of lambda, you just assumed there were just A and C, and then for omega, again, A and B, but the values that A has could come from omega and lambda. How did you count them separately?
So I guess I was just saying what I would like now is a lower bound on the cardinality of each of these guys. So I think we, in an earlier lecture, we talked a little bit about an upper bound, like how big does these cardinalities have to be to get everything? And I mentioned that, you know, cardinality 6 for each of them is already enough. But if I say, well, what's the lowest cardinality they could possibly be? The answer is clearly the cardinality of lambda can't go below 4. If it went below 4, then I could not generate arbitrary distributions on A and C, which I know I can in the triangle. So it's got to be at least cardinality 4. But because of normalization, that means the number of parameters has to be at least 3. So I have at least 3 here, here, and here, so at least 9 overall. Anyhow, so the point is that just by this parameter counting argument, you get a nice example of a case where falsifiability is not determined by parameter counting. And Pearl makes note of this in his textbook. He doesn't give any example, but I think the triangle and the saturating class are a nice example of this. There's a lot more, as I said, you could say about why parameter counting doesn't capture falsifiability. There's a nice notion of VC dimension, having to do with description length and complexity of models. So anyways, if you're not familiar with that, I recommend it. And it's another way that you could try to assess which of different causal explanations are more falsifiable. Okay, so let me talk about a situation, again, in the idealized scenario, where you've maybe observed a distribution that has a conditional independence, like S independent of C given T. And now you maybe have a couple of hypotheses that are consistent with that. So the first one, this is sort of an example from the idea that smoking causes cancer, like maybe smoking causes tar, which causes cancer. If that hypothesis is true, I expect this conditional independence to hold. If instead somebody comes along and says, no, it's not like that at all. There's a gene that predisposes people to smoke and to develop cancer. And there's another gene that predisposes people who smoke to develop tar in their lungs, and it actually protects them from cancer, that second gene. And in that situation, I could also explain this. I could say, well, in general, yes, smoking and cancer will not be independent given tar. But when I condition on tar, I get that Berkson effect, and I can induce some correlations between smoking and cancer via this backdoor path here. Like if I condition, I'll induce correlations here, which induces correlations here. And I have these correlations. And it could be that maybe this positive correlation and this negative induced correlation, it just happened to cancel. And that would also explain this. So, you know, that's another way of saying, you know, this, which is in the saturating class for 3 observed variables, can't explain this, you know, and it can even do it with sort of non-trivial causal dependences here, not just by dropping arrows. So the question is, all right, should you prefer the left explanation or the right explanation in this case? And so there's another principle that gets discussed in the causal inference literature, which basically says this is a worse explanation because the set of parameters I can add into this model that explain this is really a set of measure 0 relative to all the parameters I could add in this model. Whereas every set of parameters I could add here will guarantee this. In other words, this independence is guaranteed by the causal structure over here, whereas here it's not guaranteed by the causal structure. It has to be ensured by choosing very specific values of the parameters. So as a physicist, we would call that fine-tuning. In the causal inference community, they tend to call this same principle that you shouldn't have fine-tuning a principle of faithfulness, namely that you should prefer the models where the conditional independences you observe are a consequence of the causal structure and not of the values of the parameters. So often this is a useful principle because in general, you might have a lot of causal structures that are consistent with, you know, your compatible in principle with your conditional independence relations, and you'd like to be able to narrow the field down. And so if you can say, well, some of these can only explain this with this fine-tuning parameters, so we'll rule those out, and we'll take the ones that make those conditional independences robust as the more likely ones. Okay, I'm gonna move on to the case of finite run statistics now. And you know, if you're doing a real-world experiment, you don't actually ever see precise conditional independences. You only ever see things that are sort of close to conditionally independent. And really, you have to sort of fit the parameters of your model. You don't sort of learn precisely the observational distribution. You have a best fit for the observational distribution based on the finite run relative frequencies you see. And so now you have to sort of use standard model selection techniques to figure out what is the most plausible causal structure. So let me sort of remind you of sort of basic ideas from model selection. So I would say the low bar in model selection is you shouldn't underfit your data. So what do I mean by that? So suppose we're talking about a situation where you just have two variables and the ground truth is some linear dependence between these two variables. There's some data points. But when you measure these variables, of course, you have some noise. So you're going to get the blue points instead of the ground truth. So there's going to be some fluctuations in both these variables. So what we generally do is we can find something like a best fit. So this here I've drawn the best linear fit of the data. So that's the one that minimizes the sums of the squares of the differences between the data points and this line. And then I can measure the error between the fit and the data as this chi-squared quantity, the sums of those squares. And that tells me something about how much statistical fluctuations there were relative to my fit. You know, how much fluctuations I have to assume occurred in the data to relative to this model that I'm fitting to. So if I change the model and I say I'm going to look for a polynomial model of the data rather than a linear model, so here's my best fit polynomial model now. And I've gotten smaller error bars, a smaller chi-squared, because you know here the deviation between the points and the line is sufficiently small that you can't even see those bars anymore. And again, the chi-squared can quantify how unlikely the data would be if this model were true. And so if all you care about is not underfitting the data, then you just want to say the data shouldn't come out as unlikely relative to my model. So in some sense, you know, this model makes the data less unlikely than this model did, right? So if you were just cared about underfitting, you might prefer this one rather than that one. But if the chi-square is good, you might say over here, well, that's still a good model. It still says that the data is pretty likely if this model's true. But that's not the whole story about model selection, because it's not just about not underfitting the data, it shouldn't overfit the data either. And that's another way of saying that your model ultimately should have predictive power. So what do I mean by that? Suppose I take the data and I divide it up into a training set and a test set, and I do my fitting of the model on the training set alone. So the model fitting procedure doesn't get to see the test set at all. So this is what the data in the training set might look like. Here's what my best fit model looked like. And now I'll call the chi-squared here the training error for that model. So again, I'll do that now for the polynomial model. Calculate the chi-squared, and that's the training error for the polynomial model. And now when that's done, I can say, well, what about the test data? So that's a different set of data. Remember, we didn't use that in the training. A different set of data with its own statistical fluctuations. And now I can do the same thing. I said, find the best fit, take the best fit linear model that I had from the training data, that's the blue line, and calculate the error between the test data and that best fit model I had. Okay, so that's going to be called the test error, the deviation between the test data and my best fit linear model here. And I can do that for the polynomial model, and that's the sums of the squares of the deviations, the test data to the best fit model here. Okay, so now what you'll notice, if I put these side by side, is that the blue curve did a good job of hitting the training data really closely, but it's doing a worse job of hitting the red points, you know, so these error bars tend to be bigger than the ones in the linear model over here, which means that by the higher bar of not overfitting the data, this one's preferred, because ultimately when you ask how well does it predict the data it hasn't seen, it does better than this one. Okay, so roughly speaking, the signature of overfitting is to have a lower training error and a higher test error. So that's what this polynomial model has. The idea is that it achieves this lower training error by basically mistaking what are statistical fluctuations for real features and choosing its parameter values to sort of think, you know, to map out those statistical fluctuations as if they were real features. But because they're not really there, that means it does a worse job at hitting the points in the test set. Okay, so this is the kind of heuristic you can use to compare different models regarding their predictive power. So you can use this in causal inference to compare models. And in particular, if you do it in an example like this one, so now your data is not ideal. You've got some finite run frequencies, and you might find, well, it's close to satisfying this conditional independence, but it's never exactly true. So for instance, you might find that even though I stratify the data by T, it's not quite the case that the distribution over C is independent of S. The distribution over C is a little bit different for each value of S. But maybe that's just statistical fluctuations in this finite end data. So what you really want to know is the sort of approximate independence I'm seeing due to statistical fluctuations away from a situation where ideally I really would have the independence? Or is it rather a real feature that lack of independence signals that there's actually something causally which really can explain things that deviate from that independence, as I could have here? And so that's sort of what you want to decide. And it really depends on the magnitude of that deviation. So this is where it's appropriate to use model selection techniques to figure out which of these is more plausible. And what you'll find is that if in fact these deviations are indeed statistical fluctuations, then in a lot of instances, models like this one, the ones that in the idealized scenario we called fine-tuned, they're going to tend to overfit the data because they'll mistake those fluctuations for real features. Like, they have the capacity of interpreting those deviations as, you know, real causal connections between things. And then when they get presented with test data that they haven't trained on, they're going to make worse predictions than these models. So this is, you can think of this as one way why you ought to prefer the not fine-tuned models. That, you know, in the real world where you've got finite run data, your non-fine-tuned models tend to do a better job of, if you put them head-to-head against a fine-tuned model, they'll tend to do a better job. They'll have more predictive power and be less prone to overfitting. Okay, questions about that? We're going to come back later in the course to an example of using this kind of model selection. Okay, well, if there are no questions, I'm going to now leave the topic of causal compatibility and adjudicating between causal models behind and move on to the next topic, which is estimating the strengths of causal mechanisms from observational data. So this is basically, you're not just caring what is the causal hypothesis. You know, maybe you've already settled what the right causal hypothesis is, and you want to know what's the strength of this influence. So I think on the first day I had an example, you know, treatment and recovery, I might want to know how much does treatment increase the probability of recovery? Or how much does attending this institution increase the likelihood of having higher future wages? That's the sort of thing that people want to estimate. Good. So we have to start with a hypothesis about the right causal structure. So everything I'm saying up till now, we imagine now the causal structure is no longer in doubt. We've committed to one. And now we're asking something about the parameters that we're adding to that causal structure. So where did that causal structure come from? Well, it could be somebody who has domain expertise says, well, this is clearly what's going on, so this is the causal structure. Or maybe we've already done model selection. Maybe we've sort of done, you know, looked at some observational data, figured out what's compatible with it, done some model selection, figured out, okay, this is the most likely explanation. And now we're in the business of saying, relative to that causal structure, what are the parameters in the model? What can I say about the values of those parameters? Okay, so from here, the next little bit, there's no doubt about what the causal structure is. Okay, so let's see some examples of trying to figure out parameters in an example of a structural equation model. So I'm gonna go back to this example that you saw earlier, where you have a lot of knowledge, a lot of restrictions on the parameters. So it's going to be the example where we know exactly what the ways that the observed variables depend functionally on their parents. And the only thing we don't know about are the distributions over the latent variables. I'm just flashing a slide you've seen before. The observed variables A and B are both binary. We just have these latent variables that are also all binary. And we stipulate in this example that A is the product of its parents, B is the product of its parents. And we can work out that for every possible set of values of the latents, these are the values of the observed, which implies that the observed probabilities are a simple function of these parameters. So the parameters are just the probability that mu takes value 0, that's Q1, probability that nu takes value 0, that's Q2. And Q3 is the probability that lambda takes the value 0. Obviously, you know, the other probability, the probability that mu takes the value 1, is just 1 minus Q1, so it's not an extra parameter. So there's only 3 parameters in this model. And so you could ask the question, if I've observed the distribution over AND B, can I infer the values of these parameters? Can I figure out what Q1, Q2, and Q3 are, and thereby sort of know everything about the causal model? So previously, we cared about not doing that. We cared about instead eliminating the Qs. So we had that whole discussion of algebraic geometry where, you know, you take a system of polynomial equations, you eliminate the Qs, you get some inequalities on the Ps. Now we're interested in a different problem, which is to solve for the Qs in terms of the Ps. So I want to just sort of invert these equations and now eliminate the Ps, express the Qs as functions of the Ps. So I'm not going to go through this in detail, but let me just show why in this example the answer is clearly yes, you can. And it's this, that remember, we talked about this example, when mu takes the value 0, it basically makes A and B both take the value 0 because mu is a product here. So I get to this point here in the corner when mu is 0. Whereas when mu is 1, A just gets to track nu and B gets to track lambda. So I get back to a different model, the one where A and B were disconnected, right? So we talked a little bit about this model as well. When A and B are disconnected, they each have local noise acting on them. What you get is just the set of possible product distributions on A and B, which looks like this fan. And so when mu is 1 over here, I get the surface of the fan, part of which is hidden, but I can get all the way to the surface. And so now, if you just say, I know exactly where I am in this space, I can just take the dot, which is my data, figure out how far is it from 0, 0 in the surface of the fan, and that relative distance tells me the relative probability that mu is 0 or 1. And then sort of where I am on that fan, like if I push out to the fan, I ask, where am I hitting the fan? That tells me exactly what Q2 and Q3 are. Right? So in this case, you know, without doing the algebra, you can figure out exactly what the Qs are from the Ps. And so that sometimes happens, where you can know all the parameters of the model. So now you've got your observational data. If somebody told you it's definitely this causal structure, you know exactly what the parameters are in that causal model. But that doesn't always happen. So here we say the parameters are identifiable, but in a different example, they're not. So take this example, which we also saw. Now there are 4 latent variables. So I already have, you know, 4 parameters here, and I'm only gonna get 3 parameters from my data. So I know there's gonna be a problem because, you know, where I am in this space is only gonna give me 3 parameters. These were the functional dependencies we had here. But again, I can think of one of these latent variables as a switch, right? So if nu is 0, it basically, because nu multiplies both sides, A and B are both gonna be at 0. And if nu is 1, then I get this other model, which is the one with nu missing and just A responding to rho and mu additively, B responding to delta and mu, this should say delta, this should not say lambda, delta and mu additively. That model looks like this one over here. And it gives you this funny structure where you sort of have a little bit carved out of each face of the tetrahedron. And so, this shape here is just the convex hull of the 0, 0 point and this shape. So it fills in this whole face here. But now if you give me a point that's, say, inside in the bulk of this region here, you don't know whether it's because nu is 1 and I generated that point just using this kind of model, or whether when nu is 1, I'm out on the surface here, but there's some probability of nu 0, and so I take a mixture of this and this point, which brings me into the ball. Those are both consistent. So there's going to be a range of possibilities for the Qs in this example, consistent with a given point I see. And as I move that point around, the range of possibilities changes, but in general, the solution of the problem is that, you know, you only have partial identifiability of the parameters in the model, and maybe you can, like, find a range of them.
Yeah, how do you exactly find the distributed shape, like, say, some parts cut out?
This shape here?
Yeah.
Well, so we talked about that in a previous lecture where we write down the expressions for the joint probabilities in terms of the Q1, Q2, Q3 of this model, and then we do quantifier elimination where we say, now I just want some characterization of the polynomial equations that these probabilities alone satisfy. So this was nonlinear quantifier elimination, what I call sort of the hard way of doing causal inference. This is just the output of using Grobner bases to do nonlinear quantifier elimination. And this is just a plot of all the probability distributions that satisfy these inequalities. That was just me trying to describe kind of like what the shape looks like. It's really kind of an intersection of three fans, and then the space between them is all filled in. So this sort of carved out region is just sort of what's left over after you take the intersection of these different fans. Okay, so again, this is sort of, you know, the brute force technique to solving the problem you're interested in, which is, okay, find the parameters that could possibly have given rise. And in general, it's incredibly hard. Like, you're trying to solve a set of nonlinear polynomial equations for some variables in terms of others. And for, you know, complicated problems, you're not going to be able to do this very easily. Okay. In the general case, in it, you're not going to be able to do perfect identification. You're only going to find a range of possibilities for the, you know, tuple of parameters that defines your causal model. Let me say a little bit more about sort of when you expect that range of possibilities to be small and when you expect it to be large. So take the really simple example where A causes B. A and B are both binary, both observed. We talked about this one before, that the conditional probability B given A can in this case be thought of as just a mixture of the possible functions that relate A to B. So because they're binary, there's only four possible functions: identity, flip, reset to zero, reset to one. And so I can, and any conditional probability B given A can be obtained from, you know, ignorance of that function in this way, right? So these are the relative probabilities of the four functions. This is how B depends on A for each of those four functions. And so what I noted, I think it was the second lecture, that different probability distributions over these functions can yield the same conditional probability in the end. So if I have equal weight of identity and flip, those are, as stochastic matrices, they look like this and this. That gives me what I call the completely randomizing channel. So this channel is such that whatever the value of A is, B gets prepared in a uniform distribution. But also, if the distribution was with probability half, it's reset to zero, probability half, it's reset to one. Again, this is what the stochastic matrices for reset to zero and reset to one are. But when I add them up like this, I'm back to the completely randomizing channel. So one and the same stochastic matrix can come from two different distributions over the functions. And in fact, any distribution, which is a weighted sum of this mixture and this mixture with, say, relative weight q and 1 minus q, will also give me the complete randomizing channel. So if I care, it, we talked in the second lecture about how the causal mechanism is really that function. So if I really want to know what's my ignorance of the function underlying it, if all you give me is the stochastic matrix, I'm left with a lot of ambiguity as to what the function is. There's these different distributions over functions that are consistent with what I've seen. So it's useful to see geometrically what that looks like. So if I start with the space of probability distributions over the four functions, it's just a tetrahedron, right? The simplex over four points. And if I ask, well, what do the conditional probabilities of a from one bit to another look like? Well, they form a two-dimensional space. So because of normalization, I only need to tell you for a given value of A, say A is zero, what the probability of one value of B is. So let me just conventionally take that to be the probability that B is zero. That's one axis. The other axis is when A is one, what's the probability that B is zero? And so it's just this square here where those probabilities range from zero to one. And so if you ask, well, what's the mapping from these distributions onto this square? Turns out it's just a projection. If you think about it, if you arrange the tetrahedron so that you're sort of looking down on one of the edges, right? So imagine you sort of are looking down on top of this edge with this edge below it. It'll look like a square. These will be the four vertices of the tetrahedron as you're looking down on it. And these correspond precisely to those points, right? So the identity function is one such that if A is zero, B is zero, so there's probability one here. And the probability that when A is one, B is zero, well, that has probability zero, because when A is one, B will always be one for the identity function. So that should be down at zero, so I'm at this point. And similarly, if you go through the other functions, you get to the other points. And this point in the middle is the situation where I have an equal mixture of identity and flip, or an equal mixture of reset to 0 and reset to 1. That'll get to, both of those will get me to the same point for the conditional probability. And in fact, everything on the line of the tetrahedron that extends from the first mixture to the second mixture, that whole line all gets projected down to the same point in the conditional probabilities. So that's exactly the ambiguity we talked about on the previous slide, where I had this one parameter family of distributions over the functions. That's just exactly this line here. And so as I consider other points in this space, if you think about sort of the line you can draw through the tetrahedron, the closer I get to one of the vertices, the shorter that line becomes. Right? So if I'm really at one of the vertices for the conditional probability here, I know that I was a point distribution on this function. And as I move away from it, I move away from a point distribution on that function, and I have a little bit of ambiguity as to what sorts of distributions could have given rise to it, but I have a lot less uncertainty than when I'm right in the middle of this space. So that's a generic feature, actually, that if, you know, in general, we have these higher dimensional spaces of conditional probabilities. But the closer you are to the boundary of that space of probabilities, so like if you're looking at Hardy-type correlations where you have some zeros in your probability distribution, that tends to make it easier to figure out what the parameters in the model is. There's fewer possible parameter choices that'll give rise to those distributions. So there's lots more that could be said about the problem of kind of identifying the distribution over functions in the model from the conditional probabilities you observe. But I guess I just wanted to say that one thing, that it's at the boundaries that you can get the most information. Most of the work in classical causal inference that's in this range of sort of estimating the strengths of causal influences have focused on what are called due conditionals and identifying them, figuring out when you can estimate the values of due conditionals from the data. So I'm going to remind you what a due conditional is in a moment, but let me just contrast what we're about to do with, you know, things we've done up till now in terms of causal compatibility. So in a lot of the techniques we talked about where, you know, we were trying to figure out what the right causal hypothesis was, we looked at different model classes and relations between them. So we might look at the instrumental model and some version of it where I've kind of come in and imagined an intervention on X. Here was a split node intervention. We have a new version of X and the old version of X. And then I sort of can leverage facts about what these two kinds of models have in common. And in particular, like what sorts of distributions over the XY given Z, what are the possibilities for the distributions over XY given Z in this model class relative to this one over here. Whereas what we're going to be doing now is saying that we're not thinking of model classes anymore. We're sort of thinking of the actual world, which is an element of the model class. So there's some particular conditional probabilities that hold in the actual world, right? So if I'm thinking of a particular drug and, you know, how it influences recovers, there's going to be some matter of fact about what these conditional probabilities are, given the information that I have. So it's an element of some model class. And then what we're going to be doing is imagining kind of different versions of that. So I want to think of these as sort of counterfactual worlds. So it's not the case that somebody has done an intervention on X in the real world, but we're going to imagine a world where that had been the case. So that means that the node that I'm intervening on, like X, it's not going to be distributed the way it would have been in the real world. It's going to be, I'm going to imagine it takes some new value, but everything else has stayed the same. So these parameters are going to be, we're going to imagine that they're the same as they are in the real world. So previously, we sort of had imagined cases where the set of possibilities for parameters had exactly the same scope. Here, we're imagining a case where the actual values of the parameters are exactly as they were in the actual world. So although we're going to have some very similar pictures on the left and the right, here you have to remember that we're not talking about model classes anymore. We're talking about a particular element of the model class. OK. So take a simple example where in the actual world, you just have X, so you care about the influence of X on Y, but you have this sort of structure, where W is a common cause of X and Y, it's observed. These are the parameters of the model, so when I compute Y given X, it looks like this. And Y given X is really best interpreted as, if I learn the value of X, what should I infer about Y? And you know, we saw examples in the drug trial where you know what X tells you about Y might not correspond to the causal influence X has on Y. And indeed, the causal influence X has on Y should really be thought of as something different, which is referred to as the due conditional, and it's defined this way. So we write it, Y given due of X in the world with graph G is what X would teach you about Y in a different counterfactual world, G prime, wherein you had intervened on X. So I draw that this way, where all the arrows that go into X naturally are suspended, they're dropped, and I imagine that X now becomes an input. So I can set it to any one of its values. So note that this is exactly what you would do if you had done a randomized controlled trial. I said, well, I'm not going to let, say, somebody's gender decide whether they're going to take the drug or not. I'm going to either give them a drug or a placebo at random. That's what we're imagining here. So we're defining the due conditional in the real world in terms of this imagined intervention on the variable X. So you can work out for, you know, each the parameters in this model have to be the same as the corresponding parameters in this model. That's what I'm imagining. That's the sense in which this counterfactual world. I've changed how X depends on its parents, but everything else I've left the same. So I'm imagining a world that has only changed in that I've intervened on X. So in this world, what I would see for Y given X is precisely what, you know, the Markov condition gives you. It's just Y given W and X times the probability of W marginalized over W. So this is really what I want to estimate to figure out the causal influence of X on Y. Okay, so here I'm just saying what I described a moment ago. Let me flash what this distinction between the regular conditional and the due conditional looks like in the language of these circuits, where sort of inference and causation are really clear. So this is the model on the left of the actual world where you learn X, right? W is a common cause of X and Y. You've learned X, and you know, maybe you get a joint distribution over X and Y from your observations of X and Y. And you can show that that joint distribution has the same kind of structure. It sort of follows the causal structure. So what you learn about W is pertinent, W is pertinent to X and to Y. So the joint distribution over X and Y can be thought of as being due to some variation in W, which then influences X and influences Y and leads to variations of both of them. And X also influences Y. So this is sort of the structure. And therefore, if I compute the conditional, you know, what do I know about Y given X? There's a way you could do this graphically, but I just sort of wanted you to, don't worry about that, just look at the structure. When I compute this, it turns out that X now teaches me both about W and about Y. So it teaches me about Y in two ways. It teaches me about Y directly, but also through W. And that's different from the case where I would intervene on X. So this is where this expression comes from, that just the regular conditional X given Y has a component where I learn about Y through X and W, and also I learn about W through X. So this is a conditional. Whereas if I, so I'm just going to move this to the top of the page. If I look at the case where I've intervened on X, then this is what the conditional looks like. Now there's only one way that X teaches you about Y, which is directly rather than through W. So now instead of having this P of W given X, I just have P of W. And so the change in the causal structure has changed the way that my conditional probability depends on the parameters in the model. Okay, this is also meant to just be a reminder that, you know, when we write down equations like this, it's really about the structure of inference, about what we know. It's not so much about the causal structure, it's more a shadow of the causal structure on the structure of our knowledge. Okay, so this is just the slide I showed you before. So remember that if you learn the due conditional, you can infer something about the possible distributions of the functions, which is ultimately what the strength of the causal mechanism is. And you can sometimes learn more about that distribution of the functions than the due conditional tells you. So in lecture two, I mentioned this example of the Vernum cipher, where you know the due conditional is just the randomizing channel, but you can sort of figure out that because you can decode the ciphertext, you can figure out that it's really either identity or flip the map from the plain text to the ciphertext. not reset to zero or reset to one. But nonetheless, even though there's sort of this extra information that you could hope to get about this, most of the literature sort of settles just on the question of inferring this due conditional. It doesn't worry about estimating this. The main problem that you read about in the textbooks on classical causal inference is about inferring the due conditional. So that's what that's all I'm going to do in the next bit is sort of talk about all the techniques for inferring the due conditional. All right. The challenge, of course, is that whenever the variables you're interested in, x and y, don't just have a directed causal path between them, but they also have some common cause acting on them, so something in their common ancestry, then just computing the regular conditional y given x from the observed distribution over x and y, well, that's not going to be equal to the due conditional, so you're going to have to do something else. So whenever that happens, whenever the regular conditional is not equal to the due conditional, then we say x and y are confounded, and we need some different tools. I want to tell you that about some techniques for inferring the due conditional even when the two are confounded. So let's go to this, the simplest example I gave before, where we have this confounder which is observed. So remember that the due conditional is just defined as the regular conditional over here in this possible world on the right. And so if I think about this term, so this is what I want to estimate now, P of W, well, that's identifiable. That's just the marginal on W. W is observed. So I get that from my data. Similarly, this P of Y given WX, that's also just computable from my data. I can just take the joint over X, Y, and W and divide by the marginal on W and X. And so this formula here is something that I can compute from the observed distribution. So even though the due conditional is not given just by the standard Y given X, I can compute it from the observed distribution. It's this expression. And the difference from the regular conditional is the regular conditional would have had a W given X here. And so I don't take W given X, I just take the marginal distribution on W. That gives me the due conditional. Okay, so this should look a bit familiar because way back in the first lecture, we talked about Simpson's paradox where we had this strange reversal of conditional probabilities. You know, for the men and the women, the conditional probability of reversal given the drug was less when you got the drug than when you didn't, whereas the opposite in the general population. And I said then that, you know, ultimately that boils down to the difference between the regular conditional and the due conditional, and that you should, you know, focus on the gender-specific ones. So the point is this, if you want to find the average due conditional, so not take the stratification for men and women, but just say on average is the drug good or not, then you stratify by the common cause, like W in my previous example, here is gender, and then you take the weighted average of the different strata based on their relative frequency in the population. So that's what you're doing here. You're just taking the probability distribution over gender, and you're multiplying the probability recovery given treatment and gender by those weights rather than taking the conditional. And that's how you get out of Simpson's paradox. So here's the due conditionals, right? So I've just written it out explicitly. The probability of recovery given that you do take the drug is the probability of recovery given that you took the drug and you're male times the probability you're male. The regular conditional just takes the probability of male given that you took the drug. So here I'm weighting these two terms by things that aren't necessarily the relative probabilities of men and women in the population because I have to condition on the drug variable. So when I take this weighted average, the inequality has to go the same way as it did here and here. Because I'm taking the weighted average on the left and the weighted average on the right, that's going to respect the same equality. So that's why the due conditional is going to give me the same sort of result as the different strata here. Whereas this guy can reverse the inequality because I'm not weighting the two sides equally. Here I'm weighting these guys by the probabilities of gender given drug, whereas over on the right, I'm weighting them, so this should say no drug, that's a typo, by the probabilities of men and women given that they didn't take the drug. And those can, so that's ultimately how you resolve Simpson's paradox. It's you should be focused to know if a drug's effective, you should be focused on the due conditionals, not the regular conditionals. And this example, the due conditional is easily calculated. Okay, let's imagine something a little bit more general, where now instead of just having one variable y, I have a whole bunch of variables, which I'll write by this bold z, but I want to consider what happens when I intervene on variable x. So if I just think about the Markov condition in the graph G that describes all these variables z and x, it's, remember, just going to be the product of every variable given its parents. So there's all the z's, these are the zi's given their parents, and then a term for x and its parents. Now if I say, well, what about the model where I intervene on x? So all that changes, so that's the definition of the probability of all the other variables given to x, is just that probability distribution in a modification of g, where all I've changed is that I'm now intervening on x. I'm not allowing x to depend on its parents. I'm setting its value. So all that changes is that I lose this stuff here. X becomes just an input. And so it's just the product of all the other variables given their parents. That's going to give me the joint distribution over z for any value of x. So if I look at those two expressions and I say, what does that mean in terms of identifying the due conditional? Well, this due conditional is just this product, which is just this term. So I can just take this divided by the probability of x given its parents, and that'll give me an expression for the due conditional in this general situation. Okay. So from that, I can derive what's called the parental adjustment formula, which just says that if y, the variable that I'm interested in, is not x nor any parent of x, then I can write the probability of y given to x as just the probability of y given x and the parents of x, weighted by the probabilities of the different values for the set of parents of x, and then marginalized over the set of parents of x. Okay, let's just go through the proof of that. So this is what I did on the last slide. You know, for some set of variables, bold z, this is what the due conditional looks like. It's just dividing by the conditional of x given its parents. Take the set of variables z to be y and everything else. So I'm just going to call everything else w now. So I can rewrite the probability of z given to x as just the probability of y and w given to x. Ultimately, I'm going to be marginalizing over w to just get the conditional for y. So I've just substituted in z as y and w into this expression. And now I can rewrite that by just noticing that the conditional x given parents of x is just the joint distribution over x and its parents divided by the marginal distribution over its parents. So I've just plugged that in and brought the probability for the parents up to the top of the equation. Next, I want to split off the parents of x from w. So w prime is now going to be everything in w that isn't a parent of x. So again, I'm just going to take this equation and plug in this new way of writing w as w prime and the parents of x. But now it's clear that once I have rewritten this equation, when I divide this joint distribution, or y, w prime, x, and the parents of x, divided by the joint distribution of x and the parents of x, that just becomes this conditional. Y, w prime, given x and the parents of x. This thing stays around. And now all I have to do is marginalize over w, because I really want to calculate p of y given to x. So I say, all right, take the marginal over w on the left-hand side. I'll get what I'm looking for. So I take I marginalize over w on the right-hand side, and that means summing over both w prime and the parents of x. So I do that. The dependence on w prime goes away. I'm just taking the marginal now. And I'm just left with the sum of the parents of x of this conditional and that conditional, which is what we were trying to prove. So it basically says, if you're interested in the effects of intervening on x, condition on the parents of x, and then weight by the different strata of the values of the parents of x in a sum, and you'll get the due conditional. So our simplest example from before is just an example of that. Because if you ask, what's the full set of parents of x here? It's just w. So I take y given w and x, w is the parents, weight by the probability of the parents, and marginalize. And that'll give me the due conditional. But in some cases, the parents are not observed. Like here's a simple example where the parent of x is lambda. I can't observe it, so I can't condition on it. So what am I going to do in this sort of situation? Well, we know from our discussion of deseparation that if you condition on z, you're going to eliminate all the correlations between x and y that are due to the common cause, lambda. You're going to block this path between x and y. And so the only correlations that are going to be left between x and y in this case are going to be due to the cause-effect relationship between them. And so that means that if we stratify the data by Z now, and we take a weighted average of those strata, we should again get the do conditional, the thing we're interested in. So in this case, the formula will look like this. But I could give you different examples where there's, you know, many pathways between X and Y and lots of things that are unobserved. And the question is, in general, how do I compute the do conditional? So there's a general result called the backdoor criterion. So it tells you when you can identify the do conditionals using a certain formula called the backdoor adjustment formula. So let me explain that. It's a generalization of this example I just showed. So first of all, what's a backdoor path between X and Y? It's basically any path between X and Y that has an arrow leading into X. So let me use a complicated example from a previous lecture where we had all these variables. I've highlighted the three backdoor paths into X. So if I look at sort of, there's many paths that come into X, but these paths here, they have arrows coming out of X. This is the only one where the arrow's into X. So if I find a path between X and Y with an arrow into X, like this one here, that's a backdoor path. Here's another one, this path between X and Y that leads into X, or this one that backtracks a bit and comes back. These are all backdoor paths into X. So all of them, in principle, could generate correlations between X and Y that aren't due to the causal effect of X on Y. So they're things we're going to want to screen off the correlations that are going through these sorts of paths. OK, so then the next thing is to say, all right, well, let's find what's called a set of variables that satisfy the backdoor criterion. So Z satisfies the backdoor criterion relative to X and Y if no node in Z is a descendant of X, and that set of variables manages to block every backdoor path between X and Y. So we're basically looking to sort of make sure that all the ways that X and Y can be correlated in a common cause fashion are blocked by our set of variables, but we don't block any of the direct causal pathways from X to Y, right? Because that would then be reducing the amount of causal influence X has on Y just spuriously by sort of conditioning on that. We want to leave all those pathways unblocked. OK, so in my example here, if you say which sets satisfy the backdoor criterion, well, A, which is just the parent of X, you know, there's only sort of one way into X. There's one arrow into X from A. So if I just condition on A, it blocks all these paths. A's in a fork in all these paths, and so that does it. It blocks it. And that just corresponds in this example to conditioning on the parents. If I had many other variables that also pointed into X, I would have to start blocking all those other paths as well. And one thing I could do is just condition on all the parents. But you know, there's other choices, like I could go A and C. C is also at a fork, so it does a good job of blocking this path and this. Actually, it just blocks this path. But the point is, that's just gravy, right? If I happen to block this path by A and by C, that's fine. So A and C, strictly speaking, satisfy the backdoor criterion. More interesting would be an example like B and C. So for, you know, suppose A is not observed. You don't have the option of conditioning on A. Well, you can still block all these paths by conditioning on B and C. So B blocks this path because it's a chain, A, B, H, so it blocks this path. Here, it would open up the path because it's at a collider. But I'm also conditioning on C, which then manages to block this path. Here, B is on the chain, so I'm blocking this path. So I've blocked all the backdoor paths by choosing B and C. And so, you know, if A is unobserved, but B and C are observed, that's okay. I can still calculate the do conditional here by conditioning on B and C. Okay, so that's the third step. I wanted to say one other thing here, that if you look at like H, for example, it's a descendant of X, so it does not satisfy the backdoor criterion. Even though it, you know, blocks this path, for example, it appears on the causal pathway for X and Y, so you don't want to condition on it. That would be a mistake if you're trying to compute the strength of causal influence, which is why, you know, the definition of the backdoor criterion insist that no node in Z is a descendant of X. Okay, so the final thing is, you know, the backdoor adjustment formula. Basically, it says if you found a set of variables Z that satisfies the backdoor criterion relative to X and Y, then the do conditional can be obtained by this formula. So you're just taking Y given X and Z, that set of variables, weighted by the probability of that set of variables, and marginalized over it. So in our example, I could take this formula here, which is like the parental adjustment formula, where A is just the parent of X. But if A is unobserved and B and C are observed, I can instead take this formula, and that'd be a perfectly good way to estimate the Duke conditional. Okay, and for a given set Z that you're computing with, in principle, you can imagine every other variable in this DAG besides X and Y and the variables in your set being unobserved, and that'd be fine. You'd still be able to compute the Duke conditional. So to some extent, when you have a certain pattern of observed and unobserved, you're really trying, if you want to identify the Duke conditional, you want to find a set that satisfies the backdoor criterion, all of which are observed. Okay, so questions about that?
In the previous example, when you had lambda and z, and then you said instead of conditioning on lambda,
yep.
On z.
Yep.
Was that because you couldn't observe lambda?
That's right. That's right, exactly. That, I constructed that example as like, well, what if, you know, you'd like to be able to just condition on the parents, that would be easy. But maybe the parents are unobserved. Nonetheless, you still have recourse. What you really need to do is find a set of variables that block all these backdoor paths and aren't descendants of X, and you want to condition on those. And if you can find enough of those such that they do that and they're observed, then you're okay.
Here you can just observe lambda and you're okay, or you can observe B and C and then
Just observe A or observe B and C, and yeah, and other options as well, yeah. I haven't tried to come up with a comprehensive list for this example. Okay, so let's move on from backdoor, and now there's something called the front door adjustment formula, which is slightly different. So let's take this causal model, so it's different from the ones we've seen before. So you want to know what Y given due X is. Problem is that they do have a common ancestor, but there's nothing in this, you know, backdoor path in text that's observable. You just got lambda, it's unobserved. So if you think about this backdoor adjustment, you would have to condition on lambda to use the backdoor adjustment formula. It's your only option, but it's not observed. So you can't figure out the Duke conditional from this backdoor adjustment procedure. But you can do something else. You can notice the following. You can say, well, I'm interested in the probability Y given due X. But that's clearly given by this formula, which is the probability of Z given due X. So that tells me something about how X influences Z. And then the probability of Y given due Z. So this will tell me about the strength of the influence from Z to Y. This will tell me about the strength of the influence from X to Z. If I average over these possibilities, I'm going to get the overall strength of the influence from X to Y. So if I could estimate everything in this expression, then I could estimate the overall Duke conditional. So let's consider the second term first, Z given due X. So again, if I say, well, what's the definition of Z given due X? It's say, well, take this DAG, suspend the arrow into X. Imagine instead I'm intervening on X and try to compute the regular conditional over in that altered graph. Now, when you look at all the backdoor paths between X and Z in this graph G, so there's only one, right? There's a path from X to Z through the back door that's this way. But Y is a collider on that path. So if I don't condition on Y, then X and Z are blocked. That path is blocked. So basically, the path between X and Z is blocked by the empty set because of that collider. And so backdoor adjustment just says, OK, condition on the empty set and weight by the probability distribution over the empty set. Well, that's equivalent to just saying, take the regular conditional X, Z given X. So the due conditional Z given due X is exactly the same as the regular conditional for this kind of graph. And it's all because, like, if I imagine projecting this graph to the case where I'm ignoring Y, well, it's just going to be an arrow X into Z. That's all it is. And the due conditional in such a simple graph just is the regular conditional. OK, so that piece is easy. And it means that this second term can be identified from the observational data. Just take the joint distribution over what you've observed, compute Z given X, plug it in. So then the question boils down to, what about this first term, the Y given due Z? So now I have to imagine a slightly different surgery on this graph, because when I imagine intervening on Z, I'm dropping this arrow now. A different arrow is being dropped from the graph to define this due conditional. So again, I want to ask, could I identify this? And we can try the backdoor criterion. We can say, well, by the backdoor criterion, is there a way of calculating Y given due Z? So I ask, well, what are the backdoor paths between Y and Z? Well, there's only one of them. It's this one here. And X blocks that path you know, it there's an arrow into Z here, but if I condition on X, I'm blocking that path. So I can estimate Y given to Z just by the backdoor criterion. So it's going to look like this. Take, you know, Y given Z and X, weight by the probability over X, marginalize over X. So that's the due conditional Y given to Z. I can plug it back into my formula. And that's what is called the front door adjustment formula. So I think there's one prime too many here. This X should not have a prime. So here I'm summing over X prime this expression. That's my Y given to Z. And then, you know, whatever value of X I'm interested in estimating the due conditional for, I just plug that in here. So this is a typo.
Well,
yes?
Why do you say estimating, since you're trying to
identify what the condition? Yeah, I should say identifying, not estimating. Yeah, you're just computing it. I guess if your joint distribution is given by a theory, you might say, yeah, I know exactly what the due conditional is. If you've merely estimated the joint distribution from relative frequencies, then all you're really doing is estimating the due conditional from your estimates of the two probabilities. But yeah, I should really be clear that here, in principle, we're identifying the due conditional, not setting bounds on it. Okay, so let me now generalize this kind of procedure as well, that I can go to more complicated examples and identify due conditionals for them. So this is called the front door adjustment or the front door criterion. So again, we start by defining what a front door path is. So it's just some directed path from X to Y, sort of all the arrows point in the same direction. Scratch that, that's not right. It's any path between X and Y that has an arrow that comes out of X rather than into X, okay? So in our simple example from before, there's a whole bunch of front door paths. So, you know, we had the A going into X, but we had two things coming out of X. So there's the arrow to I, the arrow to F. So here's a bunch of front door paths that go through F. Some of them. Here are some front door paths that go through I. Okay, so that's what I mean by the front door paths. Next, the front door criterion. So again, you're going to look for a set of variables. I'm going to call it Z again, but it's a different set relative to the one that appeared in the backdoor criterion. So we say that Z satisfies the front door criterion relative to XY if it intercepts all the front door paths from X to Y. And there's no backdoor path between X and Z, and all the backdoor paths between Z and Y are blocked by X. So let's go through that. So I've just repeated that those conditions here. So what would be examples of set Z that satisfy the front door criterion here? So F and I is an example. So F is, you know, one of the children of X. I is the other child of X. So F manages to lie on all these four front door paths. So it intercepts these guys, and I intercepts these two paths here. Okay, so F and I satisfy the first condition. There's no backdoor path between X and Z. So I have to go looking for, are there paths that have arrows into X that connect X and F? So did I get that right? All backdoor paths between. Let's start with the third one. All backdoor paths between Z and Y are blocked by X. We'll start with the second one. So let's find a backdoor path. So here's X and F. Forget the yellow color now. What's a backdoor path between X and F? Okay, so this is a backdoor path between X and F. But it's that thing, I think I might have made a mistake. I think there's a problem that this does not satisfy, F doesn't satisfy the second condition. So, okay, I have a question mark over whether I've got this right. All backdoor paths between Z and Y are blocked by X. So let's take the paths between F and Y now. So here's a backdoor path between F and Y. So it goes all along here. It has an arrow into F, but it's blocked by X. So that's certainly going to be true for F and I, that all the back, because F and I, the only way to get to them through the back door is via X, they're definitely all going to be blocked by X. But there should be no backdoor path between X and Z. So that I thought I had achieved that by basically there being no way to connect these guys through an arrow, through through x, but I think maybe that's not right. Let me think about that for a minute. I think maybe the key is that all these backdoor paths are blocked by the empty set in my example. And so I think it should say there should be no open backdoor path between x and z. So, you know, like there's a backdoor path maybe between x and f via here, but if I'm not conditioning on h, it's fine. So I think I should have written no unblocked backdoor path between x and z, and then this example is fine. Okay, sorry about that confusion. So G, yeah, go ahead.
So it's not, there is no backdoor, there's no backdoor if you haven't, there's no unblocked path backdoor, something like that, because you
right.
have a condition on H and it's a collider. So you don't, that path is blocked.
Yeah, you're not conditioning on H, exactly. So you're not going to set up correlations between X and Z by conditioning on that collider. Let's just see. So if we go back to our simple example here, let's see. So here, if I look at X and Z, you know, that there was indeed a backdoor path between them, all the way up here. But the key was that I wasn't conditioning on Y, so I could use the backdoor adjustment formula because of that.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm basically appealing to here. It's not that there should not exist any backdoor paths, it's that they should all be blocked. So yeah, apologies for that lack of clarity. But so all I've done is sort of generalize, you know, the kinds of steps, the kinds of things we needed here to make this proof work, to the context of where Z, rather than being a single variable, is a whole set of variables. Okay, and you can read about this in the textbooks on causal inference. Okay, so if you found a set like this, so G and I is another such set. So let's look, so I take, I obviously blocks these paths. G manages to block all of these front door paths, right? Because it's on a chain in all of them. And then if I go and I say, all right, are there any unblocked backdoor paths between G and X? No, because again, there's no arrows into G. They always have to kind of come back through H, and I'm not conditioning on H. So yeah, all the backdoor paths are blocked. And if I look at the backdoor paths between G and Y, they're also blocked by X, because the only way to get to G is on a path that comes in through X. So G's fine too. So, you know, if F is unobserved, but G is observed, then I could use G and I instead. Okay. Take H as an example. Does H satisfy the front door criterion? Could be part of this set bold Z? Well, no, and for two reasons. It violates both of these conditions. So there is a backdoor path with X. So here's H, here's the backdoor path with X. So, you know, given that A and B are, you know, not blocking this path, I'm not conditioning on them, there's a way that X and H could be correlated, so I couldn't just use the backdoor criterion there. And then there's a backdoor path with Y that is not blocked by X, right? So I can go, for example, between Y and H this way, X is not along that path, so it's not blocking it. So the front door adjustment criteria would not apply if I conditioned on H. Good. All right. So then the final step is that the general form of the front door criterion is that if you found one of these sets, sorry, if you found a set that satisfies the front door criterion, then this adjustment formula applies.
But if it was found the back door is being blocked, then
yep.
The previous slide, so you have a chain as well, from A, B to H. Like X, if you don't condition on A, X and B are correlated, could be correlated. But if you don't condition on B, there's a chain from B to H. Like, it's not a... So how could B and H be correlated if you haven't conditioned on B? It might be confusing two different concepts.
Well, so here you're just going to be conditioning ultimately on X and Z. And so you know, if I'm conditioning on X on H, I'm not conditioning on A and B. So that would be an unblocked backdoor path between X and H. And so the logic of deriving the front door criterion would not go through in that case. Like, it, maybe we go back to our simple example.
There is no block.
So yeah, if in the in the in this proof, suppose there were like also, let's go all the way back to I think this step here. Suppose that there were also an arrow from lambda into z. So that would be there's sort of a backdoor path between x and z. Then I couldn't do this, right? So the only reason I could replace z given du x with z given x is that there was no correlations between x and z that weren't due to the cause-effect relationship between them.
Yeah. What I don't understand is you have a string error from b to h.
Yes.
In that particular. Now, but you have a condition on b.
Yes. That means that sort of correlations can flow along there. You haven't conditioned on it, and therefore, for the conditional distribution you're looking at, when you see correlations between the two endpoints, it could be by virtue of the common cause.
Oh, okay.
So that's when we say that the sort of blocking means sort of saying it's blocking the flow of correlations. I cannot correlate these two things via this pathway if it's blocked. And if I'm marginalizing over A and B, it's unblocked. The correlations can be set up in that way. Okay, so that's the front door criterion. In our example here, it means that if I condition y on not just x prime but f and I, and I have my fi given x here, so this is just I've replaced this bold z from the previous slide by f and I, which are my, so this is where the bold z appears. I'm just doing f and I, or I could do g and I, and these are all valid ways of finding the due conditional. And so if g, for example, is observed, I might use this one because f and I are observed. All right. So if you take these ideas and say, well, what's the most general algorithm that allows you to identify due conditional? This has been worked out. It's called the due calculus. You can read about it in the textbooks. I'm not going to go into the details of the due calculus. It's really just sort of figuring out precisely, for general sets of variables, a set of rules that allows you to identify all identifiable due conditionals. So I'm just flashing the three rules for you here. And it involves things like, when can I exchange action and observation, right? So we saw in the proof of the front door criterion, there's a case where doing X and seeing X, Z condition on do X, Z condition on CX were exactly the same. So there's a general rule that says when that's true. When can you add extra observations? When can you delete or insert do's into the formulas without changing anything? All these are sort of based on the causal structure. And so when these were first proposed, they were proposed because they were sound. Every time you applied the due calculus, you would, be able to identify some due conditional. If the rules imply that you can identify a due conditional, you certainly can. But it wasn't clear at the time whether it was complete, whether there was any other rules that would help you identify some extra due conditionals. But then ultimately it was proven by Ilya Spitzer that yes, the due calculus is complete and all the identifiable due conditionals can be found by successive application of these rules. And there's an algorithm that'll show you how to do that. Okay, so let me just end with kind of connecting back to some topics, again, we've seen before. Sorry, it's going to just be a few minutes. So this nested Markov constraint we talked about a few times. Remember, we sort of noticed that in this Verma model, there was a term that corresponded to something that occurred over here in what we call the interrupted model. And we noticed that we could solve for that function in terms of observable stuff. And therefore, because that function, if it's compatible on the left, this function is compatible on the right, we could deduce that some conditional over here on the right, given by a function, a polynomial function of the observed stuff, is compatible with M prime whenever the joint distribution is compatible with M. And therefore, compatibility constraints on this thing here, like Bell inequalities and equality constraints, could always be pulled back to constraints on this particular polynomial of observable stuff. Okay, well, ultimately, the last time we saw this, it wasn't about identifiability, but really this identity here can be thought of from the frame of identifying due conditionals. So if you had just said, I'm not interested in causal compatibility, I know that this is the model, and I'm interested in estimating this due conditional, BD given due AC, for this model. So you know the definition of that involves intervening on A and C. So this will help me define what I mean by the due conditional. It's just the regular conditional BD given AC over in this modified graph. Okay, so if that's the problem you're faced with, well, just a small modification of what we did before. So this is, I showed you this slide before where we derive this formula. If instead for a single variable x, I do this for a whole set of variables x, nothing really changes. I have a Markov condition with now a product of terms involving x. And when I intervene on x, each of those xj's now gets set, so I'm just left with this piece. So again, I can just take the quotient of the joint on the set z and the set x divided by this term here, the products of the conditionals, and I'll get my due conditional for a set given an intervention on a set. And so if I plug that formula in for the case of BD and AC, what do I get? I get the joint over ABCD divided by the conditional of every one of these guys, A and C, given its parents. So A has no parents, so it's just the marginal on A. C has B as a parent, so it's just the P of C given B. So this formula, this polynomial equation in terms of the observed stuff, comes out of this identifiability rules. And this is where the nested Markov conditions came from. And when I said that we know that we get all the equality constraints, it's because we know that these due calculus rules are complete. They'll get you everything. And so I sort of presented this in the opposite order, where you sort of learned about identifiability later. But it really is coming from these kinds of rules we've been talking about, these particular polynomial equations. Because let me just finish and then I'll take your question. That you know, the last time we saw the nested Markov stuff, the first step was kind of magic. Like, oh, you notice that there's something here that can be related to something over here. If you ask, well, how do I find out all those opportunities? The answer is you can use these rules for identifying due conditionals to figure that out. Marina, yes?
Sorry, I think I don't understand what you mean when you say that the due calculus is complete, like it gives you everything you want.
Yeah, by that I mean that it's not as if there's some due conditional which can be expressed as a polynomial function of marginals on the observed distribution, but for which the rules of the due calculus would not find that. So it's not as if there's some fourth rule or fifth rule that you need to find all the identifiable guys. These three rules do it.
That this implies that all of the equality constraints can be found by a nested Markov?
Yes, nested Markov. Yep.
Maybe the implication is there are equality constraints on the observed, so not on the observed distribution and not on the conditions.
I guess what I was trying to say is that the way the nested Markov condition worked was to find equality constraints on things in a graph where we had intervened. So like you find that you've got certain conditional independences here, like D is independent of A, for example. That's an equality constraint on this guy, and then you want to rewrite that as an equality constraint on a polynomial function of guys here. So when you notice that this particular conditional just is the due conditional, you can now use those adjustment formulas to figure out that the due conditional is just this polynomial function. And so all these equality or inequality constraints you've found over on the right-hand side become equality or inequality constraints on this polynomial function of the observed stuff. So what was previously sort of a black box for us, like, hey, there's some things over in the modified model that can be written as functions in the original model. What's going on inside that black box really is this whole due calculus. How do I identify things like this in terms of observed distributions. Okay, I think that was pretty much all I wanted to say. Well, actually, I had a few more slides, but maybe, I don't know, do you guys want to hear a couple more minutes, or should we end? You're okay, a couple more? Okay, this is just what I just said, that like if you have some identifiability result, then you can usually put that in the service of deriving causal compatibility constraints like we were doing early in the course in exactly the way I was just talking about. Okay, so then the final topic I was just like, sometimes you can't identify the Duke conditional. You can't write it as an equation of things that you observe. But nonetheless, you can put upper and lower bounds on it, on the different values inside the Duke conditional. So let me just say a little bit about that. If we go back to our example of the instrumental graph here, and we care about y given to x, well, neither the back door nor the front door criterion works because I haven't got lambda to observe. I haven't got any variables that are mediaries between x and y to make use of. So neither of those two tricks work for me. But I do have this extra instrument variable, z. And so it turns out that by using z, I can actually get bounds on the Duke conditional. So bounds that are expressed in terms of what I've observed, x, y given z. So the way it works is as follows. Remember from earlier in the course, this x, y given z in the instrumental can be thought of this way, that I can think of my hidden variable as just determining how y depends on x functionally, how x depends on z functionally. G and f are just four possibilities each, because x, y, and z are assumed to be binary here. So this lambda can have cardinality 16, and I can think of it this way. And we talked about how ultimately we're just trying to, you know, eliminate these Qs to find equations in terms of the Ps when the Qs satisfy these constraints. So here I'm not doing that, but I'm going to use these same equations. So what I do now is I just notice that I can also write the Duke conditional in terms of these probability distributions over the different functions. So I just want to know, you know, y depends on x through some function f that is basically determined by the hidden variable lambda, which, you know, specifies both f and g. So if I ask for the parameters that are unknown, those these q's, how do I write down the probability y given to x when I'm making x equal 0 and I'm asking for the probability of y being 1? Well, the answer is that the function f that relates x to y could be reset to 1. That would make y 1 when x was set to 0. Or it could be flip. So, you know, if x is 0, then it'll flip it and make y 1. And it doesn't care at all what the other function is, the one that determines how x depends on z. So I just sum over the four possibilities for the other guy. That's the formula for this Duke conditional. I can write down similar formulas for all the others in terms of those latent parameters. And so to find these bounds, all I have to do is, let's say I want the lower bound, then I minimize this probability here that I'm interested in, given by this expression. So minimize this sum of the Qs, subject to these constraints, that the Qs have to be probabilities. These particular sums of the Qs should give me the probabilities that I've observed. So this is what comes out of my data. So these all, you know, for real data, give me just numbers here, and then I solve for the Qs that minimize this quantity. And that is a linear program. And so I can do that efficiently. And so if you do it in this example of the instrumental scenario with everything binary, this is what you find, that the conditional y given to x for y and 0 has this as an upper bound. So just find the maximum value of these observable quantities. So note that these dots are just conditionings, ways of denoting the conditioning symbol. So I compute the max of these guys, that gives me my upper bound. I compute the min of these guys, that gives me my lower bound. And so in some circumstances, if these upper and lower bounds are not too far apart, you can get a lot of information about the Duke conditional, even though you can't identify it precisely. Okay. So I'll just remark that Perl actually derived, or some paper, I'm not sure it was Perl, but you can derive these inequalities that we found from the instrumental scenario from these bounds just by saying, look, the lower bound has to be less than the upper bound. Like that's a different way to derive those inequalities we saw before. So yet another connection to causal compatibility, that if you are interested in estimating Duke conditionals, you can often use that, those bounds, to also get causal compatibility inequalities like these ones here. Okay, that's it for classical causal models. And we're gonna see a lot of these topics coming back when we generalize to quantum over the next few lectures.